conference is now being recorded.
Hi, folks. Can you hear me now? Hi. I was just setting the record for the meeting. Okay, so the meeting is going to be recorded today. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so what I'd like to do is we'll start today with a presentation by Hazel Christie. And Hazel has been a professional planner for 30 years. She has worked with organizations such as the City of Kelowna and the City of Edmonton and with smaller communities and the private sector. She is currently running her own consulting firm, and she is an active member of the Healthy Communities Committee with the Canadian Institute of Planners. And she's going to speak to us today about some of the resources that CIP has produced under Class 1 and some of the activities that they've been doing. So, Christy? And there is
Hazel.
Oh, my goodness. Hazel, and there is a presentation, you guys, if you want to turn to that. Sorry, Hazel.
Yeah, no problem. So, good morning, everybody. It's morning here in Kelowna, BC. And I'm actually sitting in for Dave Harrison, who is the chair of our Canadian Institute of Planners Healthy Communities Committee. He's unable to be here because a death in the family, so I'm speaking for him. The Canadian Institute of Planners is our professional association. It represents 7,000 planners across the country. And the Healthy Communities Committee is a subcommittee of our National Affairs Committee. And we have been working with Heart and Stroke on the CLASP program now for a number of years. And our focus is basically to get information, tools, and resources out to our membership. Most, not all, but most of our planners are involved somehow with the built environment, with community development, that type of thing. So this topic is of extreme importance to them. As part of the CLASP 1 initiative, we first took a survey of our membership to determine what were the tools, information, and resources that they needed in their work to further the goal of healthy communities. And based on what we received back from our survey, we received responses from over 800 planners. Basically, we then went on to produce a number of resources. We worked with Urban Public Health Network to produce an inventory database of case studies, guidelines, et cetera, that would be then made available to our membership. We produced various fact sheets to assist them in understanding the latest research in the fields of health and built environment. We also produced case studies, a practice guide, which interviewed various planners across the country and the initiatives that they have undertaken to further the goals of the healthy built environment within the work they were doing, such as official community plan work and design work, et cetera. And all of these, in addition to all of these, we are trying to get the message out to our planners. We have interacted with health professionals in a number of arenas because one of the things we feel that is very important is the collaboration between the professions. From my own point of view, I'm very much involved in local government. And, I see where these decisions get made by local councils week by week. Subdivisions get approved, developments get approved, budgets for roads and transportation get approved. And it always seems to me that we never really get enough input from the health professionals on some of these key decisions that are being made that are going to affect our communities, 50 years hence. So, the collaboration between the professions, is something that I think is really important. We also produced various webinars, wrote some articles, tried to get the message out in as many ways as we could. Those information, the particular information and resources that we produced are all available on our website, and I hope that some of you have already accessed them off our website, CIP-ICU, and I can't remember the rest of it. However, they're available on our website, and we are trying to get the information out because it's all very useful, very valuable information. That was CLASP 1. We are now into our second phase of CLASP, and we are still very actively promoting the resources and the information and the collaboration that has come out of the CLASP 1 phase. In addition, and I'm on slide 4, by the way, in addition, we are doing some research into legislative barriers across the country. Now, planning is something that varies by province, you know, our processes, our interaction with other levels of government, et cetera, is all provincial legislation. And what we have noticed in our work is there's some key differences in the provinces in the way they approach some of these items. So we are doing a little research into these various legislative barriers or differences between provinces, you know, hoping to make some recommendations again back to our membership for ways to further our goal here. We are also doing two pilot programs training in this area, and for now they are in Alberta and Quebec. Again, training or assisting planners to work more closely with health professionals on the issue of the healthy built environment. Also, we are launching some initiatives with the planning programs across the country. What we hope to encourage is research by planning students, collaboration between the planning schools and some of the public health programs in this area. And so we are going to be launching some incentives for planning students to do their research and education in this area. And again, you know, we want to continue with all our communication efforts, again, to our membership. And lastly, as part of the phase two, we want to develop a CIP policy statement, something, you know, that our institute would be able to promote and publicize on this issue. We previously had prepared a policy statement on climate change, and that was very effective for our institute to promote itself, you know, to various politicians, other agencies, et cetera. We want to do a similar policy statement on this issue. So moving on to our last slide, and again, David had prepared these, and so the last slide talks about the various structures within the Canadian Institute of Planners and where we fit within those policy issues, which is something that I started with, so apologies to my listeners for that. But anyway, that concludes my comments on this topic, and if anybody has any questions for me, I'd be very happy to hear them.
This is Kim. I'll just kind of point out to people that the resources for CIP are linked on our resource page with our new Healthy Canada by Design Hub website, so you can get them through there. And also, I just want to point out that some of the research briefs that that Hazel was referring to, one of them in particular is a 12-page kind of research brief called Active Transportation, Health, and Community Design. And CIP produced this, I believe, with the Canadian Institute of Health and Heart and Stroke Foundation. And it's a really nice piece of work, and it's got some really nice summary of some of the best health evidence that's around. And they've tried to use Canadian evidence whenever they could. So if people are looking for a nice, tight resource, that's a very good one.
Maybe, Kim, you can just send out the link to that after this call, so everyone just has it in their emails.
Okay. And again, the link is already on the website. So, I mean, I can do that, but it is on the website under resources, and it's referenced in our resources fact sheet that I've sent to everybody. Okay. Okay. Any questions for Hazel about CIP or how they've worked with the coalition, or maybe how the CIP guide, the Healthy Communities guide that they prepared, could be used?
I have a question about the last slide. This is Karen. The five national themes, I'm sorry, I'm not sure what all of those things stand for, IPPC, CC, HC. I'm wondering if people can just elaborate
okay.
a little bit. And how,
okay.
how is that structured, the themes versus the subcommittees?
The themes, IPPC is Indigenous Peoples Planning Committee, CC, Climate Change, HC, Healthy Communities, and then the other ones. And those are issues of concern to CIP and the various standing committees that we have are working and doing research on those various issues. So Healthy Communities is one of those key issues that CIP has identified.
Okay. And how, can I just ask the question of how, like, in terms of the interface of folks in public health and CIP, like, how is that occurring through the themes, the advisory committees, and the subcommittees? Like, I'm just wondering about how that interface is occurring. Clearly it's occurring, you know, because it sounds like you're working with UPHN, et cetera. But, I mean, do you have folks from health on some of your committees, or how does it work?
Our committees are planners, and okay. the collaboration is occurring from what I know, the collaboration is occurring through various provinces at provincial levels. So, for example, on our Healthy Communities Committee, we have representatives from all of our planning affiliates across the country. And so, you know, for myself, I work with the BC initiatives. Our member from Ontario is working both with the Ontario Provincial Planners and Professional Planners Institute and with initiatives that are going on in Ontario. So we do tend to be working at provincial levels, but our committee is a national committee.
And Karen, maybe to add to what you're saying, is when CIP interfaces with other partners at a national level, it tends to be through the CLASS partnership, where we're kind of, I believe that's how it happened last time with Hazel. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and something we're very cognizant of is that, you know, the legislation is very by province, and each province is doing things in a slightly different way, and this is something that, you know, we're trying to come to terms with in terms of, you know, how different provinces are approaching it and working towards getting something that's a little more coordinated on a national level.
Have there, through your research so far, have you identified things that public health people, like members of the CLASS from public health here, can assist you in terms of some of the policy or legislative barriers, or
coming out of our study of the legislation. Because, you know, from what we've learned through, you know, working with different planners across the country, there's some key differences between provinces in terms of, you know, how provinces require their municipalities to do their planning, you know, the various requirements of process and official community plan and regional planning. There's some key differences there, and so that's something we want to know a little bit more about so that we can then, you know, reach out and do the and encourage that collaboration. Right now, the collaboration is less formal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Hi, this is Regina. Can we ask a question? Is that possible?
Sure.
Great. Just based on the from our understanding of just this conversation here, is there a report on healthy communities in each province, and is that accessible to each health region and through the province, just so we can have a greater understanding of what CIP's role is in our province and healthy communities?
Each province appears to be doing things slightly differently And so I'm not 100% familiar with what's going on in Saskatchewan. So I don't have a good answer to your question. We know that each province does things just a little bit differently. Each provincial ministry of health has got different initiatives that they're putting forward, and so this is something we do need to know a little bit more about so that we can promote that information and that collaboration.
So is this something that will be coming from each province to CIP? Is there going to be a reporting structure?
Yes. Well, that's the focus of our research. Okay. And we are going to be looking at these legislative differences. We are going to be talking or surveying planners in different provinces to understand what those key differences are.
Okay.
So right now CIP has a guide for planners on healthy communities that CIP produced last time that's available to everybody, but it looks at it in a broad sense. And the project that the CIP Healthy Communities Committee is going to do this time is that they're going to try and do key informant interviews in each province to find out how those systems are different, what legislative processes are different, what policies they might have in place. They're going to try and examine some of that and bring that forward. So that'll be their project, one of their projects for Class 2.
That's great.
And is there some way to find out who our provincial representative is at all so that we can kind of improve communication from our end with them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can make that information available afterwards. I don't have everybody's emails right now, but I can make that or Kim has that information.
You know, I can follow up on that later. But when you're saying that, Hazel, would it be a provincial rep on the CIP committee, or are we looking at the provincial organization at that stage?
It's a provincial or an affiliate rep on the CIP committee. There are seven provincial planning affiliates. The Atlantic Planning affiliate is one, and so there's seven of CIP affiliates across the country, and each one has a rep on our committee.
Okay. Well, I can make that available. So I'll follow up with you on that, Hazel, if I'm not clear, and I'll get that back to people after the meeting today.
Thank you.
Can I also ask the question, are there also, so in addition to the key provincial CIP reps that you're going to make available, which is a fantastic question and idea. I was going to ask, are there key provincial public health or health, Ministry of Health people that CIP has already been working with that, you know, our different class members here from public health should also connect with?
I'm going to have to defer to Kim on that one.
I don't know about the CIP, but I think I think in each province it's a little different, and that I think that
well,
might
I
be
mean,
something
is,
we have to go
example,
to our members for.
Yeah, you know, I'm more familiar with the British Columbia example, and you know the Healthy Built Environment Alliance, which is a collaboration of you know many health professionals and other stakeholders, and so I'm more familiar with British Columbia. I'm not so familiar with what goes on in Ontario or Quebec, et cetera.
But maybe that's a question that we just put to our members in terms of networks. Like in Ontario, there's the Ontario Public Health Association. There's the Ontario Public Health Association that has a built environment work group that's quite active, and it has a listserv. And so, you know, someone like myself in Ontario, I'm connected to that. So I think it's a matter of finding out who the networks are that people use in the different provinces. And I don't think any of us really have much understanding of each other's provinces.
Yeah, no, I was trying to get at, for example, if CIP, if in any of the provincial affiliate reps of the seven of them, if some of them are already working with a provincial Ministry of Health counterpart, it's just maybe...
I'm sure that they are.
Yeah.
David Harrison, our chair, is from Nova Scotia, and he's very active in what goes on in that province.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that they are. I just I'm not 100% sure of all those details.
Yeah, but okay, it's fine. I guess, you know, if you provide the list of CIP reps, maybe the class public health folks here can find out themselves.
Hi, this is just Pam from Regina, and I just wanted to point out that we do know who our rep is on the CIP group, and she's from the city, and we know for sure that there is no connection between our Ministry of Health and this individual that's on that group, nor is there a connection between us and this individual. So that's kind of why we're wanting to know a little bit more information on kind of how can we get connected so that we know the information that's being passed back and forth, and we can provide input into that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. Yeah.
I'm
just suggesting that if there are any provinces in which health and CIP are already connected, it may be good to for the folks here who are reaching out to the CIP reps also potentially reach out to whoever that health person is so that everything's coordinated.
Okay.
It's not
good suggestion and something
always,
that our committee can follow up on.
It's not always that clear either because in Ontario, the public health people tend to work with OPPI, the Ontario Public Institute, but also people tend to work more with their local public health departments and that. The relationships are not always, it's not like there's one or two people. It's a little more complicated than that. But I think it doesn't hurt to find out who CIP is working with, and I think to provide those names, the affiliate names to our reps is really helpful. Any other questions for Hazel? Okay, so Hazel, thank you very much. You're welcome to stay on, but I know that you've got other commitments today, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks everyone.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
So folks, our next presentation is by Shilpa Mendota. Am I saying that properly?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, and Shilpa is with Peel Region Public Health, and she's going to speak to us today about the Healthy Development Index that Peel developed and they're under Class 1. Tell us a little bit about how it was developed and how it's being implemented. So, Shilpa, I'll take away. Can I ask people to just hit *4 to mute their phones, and then to unmute them, you just hit *4 again. There's some background noise, and I think it just makes it a little easier for the presenter if she can't hear us all. So if everybody could hit *4 now, and then when we open up for questions, I'll remind you to hit *4 again, okay? Okay, Shilpa?
Okay. Great. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So like Kim said, I'll just be giving you an overview of the Healthy Development Index, how it was created, how we're using it now, and then maybe you can come away with some ideas of how you could use it as a resource as well. So if you go to slide 2, this is just kind of to give you an overview of how the region works. We're a two-tiered system. So at the region, we have our corporate services, our employee and business services, our human services, as well as our public works, which incorporates development services as well as transportation planning. And then that's also where we sit as public health and our division of chronic disease and injury prevention. So we do all the programming, but with our built environment projects, we work with all of our municipalities. So we have, the City of Mississauga, the City of Brampton, and the Town of Caledon. And each of them have their own development and planning and transportation departments in there. So moving on to slide 3, just to give you an idea of where Peel is in our context, we're just west of Toronto. We have rapid growth. We're about 20,000 people each year are coming in, and it's uneven. So about 4.2% are moving into Caledon, which is a very rural area. We have Brampton, which is that middle core, and that's about 28.8%, and then Mississauga, which is the southern tip of Peel, at 6.7%. And we also have very unique challenges within our region because Brampton is mostly greenfield development, Mississauga is focused around intensification, and Caledon is very rural. We have a lot of vehicle trips. We're very auto-centric. So there's a lot more single occupant vehicle trips and a lot of increasing physical inactivity levels, so which we know can lead to a lot more chronic diseases in the future. So moving on to slide 4, this is just sort of to give you a background of how we started to work with planning. So in 2005, Peel Public Health released the State of the Region's Health Report. And that kind of focused on the unhealthy weights associated with health consequences in adults. And this report is available online if you ever want to look at it. But it really highlighted the impact of the built environment on health. And from there, we had council resolutions for planning and health to collaborate. So if you go to slide five, in 2005, planning and health, we submitted a report to council titled Overweight, Obesity, and Related Health Consequences in Adults. And again, council really embraced these resolutions, and this really initiated the collaborative work between the departments of planning and health. So from there, together, we started to comment on development applications, planning policies for active living, advocating for provincial policy. In 2008, we continued to advocate for provincial policy, develop policy for regional official plans, and develop policy for municipal and secondary plans. And if you go to slide six, we found that while health was submitting comments, our comments were very narrative, and they were mostly very qualitative. So planning didn't really know how to use this feedback in secondary and block plans. So this really identified the need for an evidence-based tool that was quantitative that could be used to evaluate these development applications and that planning could also understand and use and have some concrete idea of what to do with our comments. So in 2009, we developed the Healthy Development Index, and this was done with St. Mike's Hospital and McMaster University. And it led to evidence-based seven elements that were created, or that were looked at from the research. And they're really quantitative measures that we can use to evaluate these applications. So slide seven is really highlighting the purpose of the Healthy Development Index, which I mentioned was to evaluate the development applications in a consistent manner and provide health-based rationale to inform these planning decisions. And the way this was created was that the researchers looked at the academic and gray literature. They looked at the strength of the evidence. They did extensive stakeholder consultation, a policy gap analysis, and did GIS-based validation analysis. And moving on to slide eight. So slide eight really highlights what those seven built environment elements were. And these are the ones that had a strong association with physical activity, specifically with walking. So our elements are based on walkability. And this is the way to get people more active in their community and walking around. So these elements were density, proximity to services and transit, land use mix, street connectivity, road network and sidewalk characteristics, parking, aesthetics, and human scale. And if you want more information on each of those elements, our website's linked at the end of this presentation. So if you want to go on and read more about them, you can. So those are the elements. And if you go to slide nine, it gives you an example of how detailed these elements are. So for example, if you look at the proximity to a variety of services, it will go down and say that, you know, more than 75% of residential units must be within less than 800 meters of more than five neighborhood public services. So these are prerequisites and they get very detailed. The prerequisites have a stronger association with a positive health outcome, and then there's also credits, which are sort of the nice to have additional features. But what we realized from this was that the HDI, or the Healthy Development Index, really needs that policy support before it can be implemented, and that, you know, it can't be just a blanketed approach that will suit everything. It needs to really reflect on the different contextual realities that you're applying it to. So from our Class 1 projects, which are highlighted on slide 10, we have the Healthy Development Index refinement and the background study, the health background study. So the refinement allowed us to test the HDI, and we tested it in three new urbanism sites and two traditional suburban sites, and we found that the new urbanism sites score higher on the index than the traditional suburban sites. So this, again, really highlighted that need for the index to reflect each municipal context, and that it needed to be incorporated into the way that each municipal context can sort of take those elements and those targets and those different ranges in the scorecard and apply it to their own development approval process. The health background study, if you go to slide 11, really was taking, if you've ever had a chance to look at the Healthy Development Index, it's very academic and very, it's not an easy to read document, basically. It's big and it looks tiresome, a little overwhelming. So obviously planners wouldn't want to pick it up and look through it. The Health Background Study just repackaged that document into a way that anyone could use it, and it was very user-friendly. So this, the Health Background Study looked at those core elements and provided why it was important from a community health perspective. And it gives examples of different standards, it lists objectives, key questions that you can ask and look for, and different reporting and content requirements. So similar to background studies that are already mandated and required by municipalities as part of that complete development application process, this is the same sort of thing. So like the way an environmental impact study might be done, or a heritage impact study or a noise one could be done, this was the same thing, only those ones have sort of a little more easily defined criteria, but the health one was a little more complex, so that's why it traditionally has not been done as part of those other studies. If you go to slide 12, it highlights the user guide, and coming on, I've only been working with the built environment in the last year or so, but coming on as a new person, learning about the built environment, the Health Background Study has a user guide, which is a really neat educational type of tool I've found. So it really describes each of those core elements again and why they're important from a community health perspective. It also has pictures of what it could look like and how different ways that element can be achieved. It highlights different standards for development and also lists some additional resources that you could use. So anyone, you know, planners can pick this up and understand what we're talking about when we refer to the guide. But also anyone from health or members of the public could pick it up and understand these elements as well. So it's a very useful tool. Moving on to slide 13, the implementation issues, as I mentioned, it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of tool. It's just a reference document. We've been successful with our use of it because of the support from planners and engineers and management staff. And it's also most readily applied to greenfield development. As I mentioned, it really needs to be coupled with existing processes or policies or tools like the official plan for it to really push forward. And leadership needs to have clear vision and courage to help push forward with the health at the table. So it can be hard to talk about health as well when you're sitting at a table with planners and engineers, because everyone has a different thing that they need to bring to the table, but just learning to partner and understand to align those health objectives with other people's objectives as well. And moving on to slide 14, just highlight some of our successes within our municipalities. So each of our municipalities have passed council resolutions to reference the HDI in their different planning processes. So they may reference the index in transportation studies, community improvement plans, urban design guidelines, really just anything to reflect what each of them are working on in a different way, since they are so different in their environments. Slide 15 highlights some of the successes that we've been using the HDI at the regional level. So we've been incorporating it into our active transportation plan, our environmental assessment, our road characterization studies, our accessibility study, sustainable development guidelines, various different things that we're trying to incorporate the index into. Again, with slide 16, we're really looking at the successes at the municipal level. So as I mentioned, the municipalities are using the index in really different ways. So the City of Brampton have incorporated those measures in their sustainable development design guidelines. The Town of Caledon is incorporating them into community improvement plans and settlement boundary expansion studies. The City of Mississauga is creating and developing an impact statement framework. It's being used in local environmental assessments and municipal secondary and block plans. So as a region, on our final slide on 17, we're continuing to work closely with planners and engineers and integrating the HDI into planning and engineering and their different tools and different projects. We're currently going to go under an official plan review and hope to strengthen the language in our official plans. We're continuing to advocate for stronger policies at all levels of government. And at Peel, we're looking at developing a lead-by-example approach. So, for example, in our actively defined or designed buildings, trying to create stair prompts similar to what New York City did, creating active space, and creating healthy foods served and sold within our regional buildings. And that kind of highlights what we're doing. On slide 18, as I mentioned, like the Healthy Development Index and the Health Background Study and the refinement, all our different tools are available there. And if you have more questions that I can't seem to answer for you today, I can definitely email you or you can call me or anything like that. So, yeah, that kind of is a lot in a nutshell.
Thank you very much, Shilpa. If everybody wants to hit *4 and unmute your phones for questions or comments. So maybe while everybody's thinking, Shilpa, I'll just ask you a question. In terms of impact statement, are you suggesting then that with development applications, you're actually asking people to do like to kind of make
to
another
help,
study
yeah.
that they do?
Yeah, that would be the health impact statements.
And so it'll be using the guide like the Healthy Development Index to guide them in what's required?
Yeah, it would be a combination of that and the health background study. I know the city of Mississauga is still quite early on in developing that, so I can't say how it'll fully roll out, but I know that's what they're working on at the moment, yeah.
But the idea is that the developer would have to do this? Is that like you're developing a tool would have to do this?
Yeah, and then, of course, as public health staff, we're always there to support the use of the tools. So in any way that developers or planners from the city or the municipality might need assistance, we would be there to help them through.
Great. So folks,
ideally.
Any questions for Shilpa, you guys? Thank you very much, Shilpa.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing I forgot to mention was that, like, you have those seven elements, but they're best used when you have them all together. So, I mean, one alone just... It won't have the same impact, of course, but if you can use as many as possible or try to incorporate as many as you can, it obviously has the higher impact on health.
This is Karen. My question
hi.
Is, you know, when you say it's applied at the regional level or at the municipal level to, like, different guidelines and plans, like,
yep.
is it being referenced as in, like, you know, use the HDI in these plans or, like,
I know what you mean. So like how we're actually commenting back on guidelines or tools or
yeah,
anything
like
that.
How is it referenced to the guidelines?
Yeah,
like,
so
you must use these or you must use some of these or, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so okay, so I guess usually we try to get in early on a process. So if something's happening or a guideline's being developed, we'll try to be one of those people at the beginning so that our voices and our concerns are heard right from the start, because sometimes if you try to get those comments in much later on, it's just not heard the same way, right? But if you get guidelines and there's an opportunity to, I mean, sometimes they've already incorporated things like connections or bike paths or things like that, but it's also just looking at strengthening the language and then, you know, just making that heard a little bit more. So just highlighting more the bike lanes or the facilities, or maybe they overlooked something that they might, you know, they might have just forgotten about. So, and then we also do reference the index. So at the beginning, we'll say, if we can get early in onto a process, we'll talk about, you know, these are our tools, this is what they're for, these are the elements. So just kind of explaining what we have at the beginning, so they are incorporated into guidelines or sustainable development guidelines, incorporate a lot of those measures as well into their guidelines, I guess, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm just asking that, like, for example, in New York, we've got, you know, the active
mm-hmm.
guidelines, but,
yes.
you know, for example, like, we are working across agencies to incorporate language referencing the guidelines and you know, requiring the use of the guidelines actually in city projects, but in a
very
different way. So, for example, you have to identify in your in RFPs that go out, you have to identify, you have to be asking bidders and vendors who are bidding on projects to identify which active design guideline strategies they're using, but it's not mandating specific strategies it must use. You know what I mean?
So I guess similar, like when we're doing, if we're creating an RFP, like I remember when we were working on a CIP with Caledon early on, we asked that health be one of the considerations in the CIP, so that it is sort of brought there at the beginning, and that when the vendors come in, that it's highlighted as well.
So when you're talking about the Healthy Development Index being kind of incorporated, sometimes it's kind of just a reference to it. It's not necessarily mandated. It's a guideline that they can consult, but it's not necessarily required. Is that
exactly? So we're just sort of giving comments, but we don't have the requirements like our policies. We don't have anything. I guess that's why we're also trying to build that stronger language into the OP, so that we do have some like a stronger policy to refer to that, so that it can, things can be more required, but right now they're just comments. So, I mean, we try to build the partnerships with planning, with our different organizations, so that, you know, that they do use it more. But they're, I mean, usually if we're going to submit a letter back for a secondary plan or something, we will always cite, like, these are our tools, this is where they can be found, you know, and of course, like, public health staff is always there to support the implementation of the tools in their development.
Okay. Any other questions from folks?
This is Yves Leger here from New Brunswick. I'm wondering, given the fact that it's it seems to be very quantitative in nature, and that you've got obviously in your area a mix of very urban as well as more rural, how do you go about using or implementing the guide or the index in those different scenarios?
And if you have each of the municipalities are using it really differently, just depending on what they're doing. So, like Caledon, I'm involved in some of their CIP projects. So we're looking more about around walkability within their marine core area. So there we're just, I mean, you do whatever you can. Like, we obviously can't change, it's very rural, so we know the density is not going to be there. But there are things like, you know, the connectivity of the bike lanes or the street characteristics, the aesthetics and human scale piece, like those kind of things you can try to influence or try to, you know, put forward as comments. So that's the way they've kind of incorporated into their CIP, is like the walkability piece around aesthetics and human scale, and sidewalks and like trails and networks and that kind of thing, and connecting networks. The city of Mississauga and Brampton are using it a little differently. So Brampton was in the process of creating the urban design guidelines. So they've actually taken a lot of their measures from the index and tried to incorporate it that way. So everyone's kind of doing it very differently. It just depends on, I guess, the different context of the municipality. But it can be applied anywhere.
Right, so I guess you may not always use the quantitative aspects, but sort of the general themes.
Yeah. And like the user guide really helps bring a lot of those out and just explains them a little more. So that might be a good place if you want to look more into that.
Shilpa, thank you very much. I'm going to keep things moving just because we've got one more speaker.
Yeah, for sure.
And Shilpa, once again, you're very welcome to stay on. If you have other things to do, we understand. But if you'd like to stay on for Erna's presentation, you're very welcome. But thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, I will stay on. Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Great, thanks.
So, folks, we have a third speaker, and this is Erna Van Balen, and she is with the Simon Fraser University. She has a Master's in Science and a Master's of Philosophy. She has a background in environmental health from working in both Canada and the Netherlands, and she was the project manager for the CLASP Renewal Project in BC on data that's available and necessary for transportation decisions. And she's going to speak to us about that project today. And I asked her to speak a little less about the project and just kind of a little bit more about the data that was seen to be available and the data that was deemed to be necessary for transportation decisions, thinking that that would be helpful to others of you, even though her project focused on the BC mainland, the lower mainland of BC. We thought that it would still be helpful in terms of all of you thinking about where you might find data and what kind of data you might find helpful for each of your projects. So, Erna? And again, people, can you hit star 4 once again to mute your phones? And Erna, take it away.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Kim. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, they can't. They can't answer.
Okay, good. I have kind of an echo here, but anyways. Yeah, I heard a couple of familiar names and voices on the line. So, hi, everyone. I used to be at the NCCEH, and I did. I was responsible for the Healthy Built Environment inventory that Hazel already mentioned. And so now I'm working in class 2 in a really exciting project about, well, as Kim said, transportation data. So, yeah, as you probably know, this project is the first class project to be wrapping up, and that's quite exciting. So I'm going to give you a sneak preview of what we found, and but I'm also really interested in what kind of data you need and if this is useful at all. And yeah, as was mentioned several times, it really depends on the province. There are really large differences in how people, how health and transportation are organized. So if you just go to the second page, this is just really boring project aims. But basically, we wanted to look into who collects what kind of data for transportation and health, and also to connect those data collection efforts to promising practices from Canada and abroad. And it's not a comprehensive list of criteria and promising practices, but just a couple that we found inspiring. And from all that, we tried to find recommendations for actions to further integrate health into transportation planning. So on the third slide, you can see this setting. So this is the lower mainland in BC, for those of you who are not familiar with that. The two health authorities are Vancouver Coastal Health and Fraser Health. There's also another way of displaying this sort of region. We have two regional districts that don't overlap with these two health authorities, and we have about 28 municipalities from the top of my head. Yeah, so that's just an overview. And what we did, we talked to about 22 transportation planners and engineers in 15 of those municipalities. Two health authorities, two regional governments, and some other organizations that have data related to transportation. So we really asked them about what kind of data they have and what they need to integrate health into the transportation planning. And as I said, promising practices. I won't go into that, but I can tell you that one of the promising practices was actually from Peel Region, your Peel Data Center. That's really a useful way of sharing and displaying information as sort of a one-stop shop where people can find data on these topics. So in terms of data collection, there's a lot of different types of data that people collect, so anything to do with traffic counts, infrastructure, sidewalks. That's mainly done in municipalities, not so much regionally. The region, so Metro Vancouver and the Fraser Valley Regional District mainly do planning and not transportation. So transportation is a bit more local. TransLink is our transportation authority, and they do transportation. So there's some overlap there, but it's not fully comprehensive. And then things like transit ridership is generally collected by, the transportation authorities, TransLink, that operates in most of the area that I just showed you, and BC Transit, that's sort of, the rest of the province, basically. Modal split data, there are modal split data available from the 2006 census, the trip to work, but in the 2011 census, that information is no longer available, and that piece of the census was replaced by the National Household Survey, but data from that have not been released, I believe, and if they're released, when they'll be released, they're not comparable to previous data that were collected in the census. So that's kind of unfortunate. We also have a regional data collection on modal split, and that's TransLink's trip diaries, and it's comparable to the Transportation Tomorrow survey in the Greater Toronto Area. And so those tributaries are done every 5 years. And, yeah, they really, they ask all household members about what kind of trips people did and where they went, how long they took, et cetera. So we do have a little bit of modal split data, but the sample size for that is pretty small. And the data are not publicly available. The analyses are, but, yeah, as I said, they're only done every 5 years, and they take 2 years to be processed, so it's not that useful especially for smaller municipalities. Then crash and injury data. There are a lot of organizations that that collect data on those. And for example, the ICBC, the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, they receive information about all crashes that involve motor vehicles. So they have information about when and where crashes happened, who was involved, whether there were injuries among bikes or pedestrians. But again, only if one of the parties was a motor vehicle that claimed damage. There's also BCIRPU, that's the BC Injury Research Prevention Unit. That's a research organization that compiles a lot of data on injuries in the province, from BC vital statistics, from emergency rooms, from several data sources. And health authorities also have some information from hospitals in their areas, but it's not comprehensively. They do not have BC ambulance data. They only have emergency room data. And we do have a couple of folks from Vancouver Coastal and Fraser on the line, so if anything's correct, then just let me know. And then finally, physical activity data. That's probably the one that's, after crashes and injuries, physical activity is one of those that's really important for transportation planning. The interesting thing is that there's not a lot of information available on that. Most of it comes from Statistics Canada, from the Canadian Community Health Survey and Health Measure Survey. But again, it's not a lot, and the sample sizes are quite small. So that was also one of the reasons that Vancouver Coastal Health and Fraser Health are actually conducting their own health survey this year, and they are going to have some information in there on transportation modes, but also on self-reported health. So that's actually going to be a really good source of future information, but again, I think it starts this summer, so that information is not available yet. And then if you look at the next slide, we also identified needs. It really depended on the municipality what kind of data they needed. But one of the biggest needs was the sharing and access to data. Like I said, a lot of it is collected in municipalities. But municipalities are kind of, you know, their boundaries are artificial. It's much more interesting to find out where people commute and whether it crosses any municipal boundaries, and if you can identify any differences between more urban and more suburban regions. And there's a really and also the TransLink trip diaries, that's collected at a regional scale, but that's not accessible. So there's a lot of issues with sharing data and having access to existing data. Some municipalities are really interested, such as Vancouver, they're really interested in linking health and transportation, so to justify their investments in active transportation. And they do have a lot of data generally, but they just want to know what are the health questions to ask or what are the things that they should measure. And then there were quite a few municipalities who just wanted more data on transportation modes, on modal splits, on infrastructure. Do we have sidewalks? How many bike lanes do we have? How do people use them? And finally, well, kind of surprisingly, injuries and safety. But again, if municipalities are not aware of the data sources that are available, then they're really hard to find because, well, yeah, where do you start if it's not your area and it has to do with language issues and all that. And we also asked some health authorities for their needs, and well, they're really interested in, oh, you have sidewalk data. How does it work, and how do you inspect them, and what do you do with those data? So we looked at that as well. And then the next slide is just, it's a bit busy, but it's just to illustrate that idea that municipalities, different municipalities are at different stages of integrating health into transportation planning. So at the top row, you can see it's sort of the data that are currently available, coupled with the data that are generally needed. And then we coupled some practice, promising practices to those, and we have some recommendations. Let's see. Yeah, so yeah, just to acknowledge those differences. So like municipalities like the City of Vancouver may want to start, you know, they already have a lot of data, but they just want to link their data, whereas some municipalities don't have intersection counts of traffic. And I just want to know, okay, we want to start counting, but when should we do it and where? And they just need some help getting started on that. So basically, there are three things, sort of take-home messages, and they're kind of obvious, and but it's really hard if people are working in different sectors, different geographies, to really get this going. But if you think that data are available somewhere, they probably are. And that's especially true for injuries. Like I said, there were several organizations collecting them, but if you're not aware of those sources, then it's, yeah, it's really hard to find them. The second one is that as I was making this inventory, I realized that there were more needs that are, like there are needs that do not have anything to do with data. They, like especially smaller municipalities would like to have better resources, more resources to do those counts of traffic. But a lot of it, like some municipalities are not at the stage yet where they can just start linking transportation and health, and that's fine. So I really recommend to just take one step at a time. If like if you don't have any, if you don't know much about transportation patterns in your municipality, then don't start with you know, trying to link that to health, and that may take time. But it's just good to first start collecting good data, and you can, you know, adopt the way to do that from other municipalities who are more advanced in that. So that's really just, you know, give it time and acknowledge that there are differences. But I'm also really interested in, yeah, in your views. And, yeah, as we've seen, things are organized a bit differently in each province, and Hazel mentioned that, and I just saw that in the Peel region presentation. So it's really about what do you need? Do you have similar needs? Is this useful at all? Does it resonate? And, yeah, so I'd be curious to hear more about that. So if you have any questions, then I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Erna. So folks, if you want to unmute your phones with star 4, and any questions or comments on the summary that Erna has provided?
Hi, yes, I have a question. It's Ryan Whitney with the Toronto Centre for Active Transportation. Well, I'm just curious if anybody brought up the need to kind of have long-term, systematic, and continuous data collection for cyclists and pedestrians across times and seasons. So I know that there are quite a few municipalities who are working on this. Vancouver, for instance, they have, I believe, about between 40 and 60 automatic counters that are installed where they kind of they count data all times of the day, and they're continuous and automatic. Montreal also has some of this on a new lane that they put in on Saint-Laurent-de-Brébeuf, and also in Ottawa as well on the downtown Laurier bike lane. So I'm just wondering if that came up at all and if that will be included in your report.
It did, yeah. We basically listed whether or not municipalities had traffic counts and intersection counts and what they counted and how often. And intersection counts are usually done once a year, and I think most of them are actually in September, but some municipalities also expressed the need for, like, oh, if we do intersection counts, when do we need to do them? Should it be in June or should it be in September to make them comparable across the region? So, yeah, that did come up, and we do try to list those in the reports.
Great. And just to follow up on that, specifically, was it mentioned about automatic technology that's used to count all the time? So not intersection counts organized by people, but it's an automatic technology that counts all the time, so that there's no gaps in the data. So say, for instance, you would install a cycling counter and then you'd get data from like Monday to Sunday, all hours of the day. Did that come up at all?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. And yeah, we also listed the automatic counts and how many counters they have in municipalities. And there were a couple of things that came up to related to, well, to the technology of those counters. Some are laser, some are hose counts, some are in the pavement. And there are differences. I'm not a transportation engineer, but there are differences in how reliable each of those methods are. So that's another issue that came up.
Okay, that's great. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Other questions or comments?
Yeah. Yes, this is Jane from the Montreal Urban Ecology Center. And I wanted to ask, and this relates to your presentation and also the one by Hazel about the current research on legislative barriers. And I commend CLASP. It's great that this research is being done. But I think your presentation just now really underlines the need to have to be able to do some to be able to do some cross-province even comparison, because that can help us with learning how things are different across provinces as we further develop our collaborations together for planning and built environment, but also to help us to influence policy in each of our own provinces to better understand what's happening elsewhere, and it helps to put pressure on in our own places when we understand what's happening better elsewhere. So I'm wondering whether any of your work, Erna, whether much of it does comparisons of provincial data, or whether you see that coming.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I do want to try and find out, and, well, this webinar is one of the ways to do that, I think. I think a lot of it has to do with how things are organized and who's responsible for what in different provinces. And I think to get a list of that would be really useful. And I also heard about a project yesterday. Jean, maybe you know more about that, that was making a list of the sort of the legislative barriers in across the country. Jean, are you there?
Sorry, I still have my phone on mute. Yeah, that was the one that Hazel was talking about earlier on.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and so she would probably be better able to answer that than I could.
Okay, yeah, but so there is some effort trying to figure that out.
Well, and I think, Jane, what you're raising is kind of, it would be kind of nice to have this kind of project done in every province and then compare them, whereas I think right now what we've got is we've got this BC piece, and there is a Quebec piece being done as well under CLASP, but it does kind of speak to maybe, you know, it would be nice when those two projects are done to actually kind of take a look at them, and then it would be nice to actually fill in the gaps for the other provinces and compare. But I think you're right, it does help to have some of this data out there. It helps other people to look for what's in their province and what's missing. So I think that is useful. In terms of the legislative barrier piece that CIP is doing, I just want to say to people, it is a very modest piece at this stage. It's kind of a starter piece. I think what they're going to start with is a few key informant interviews, and it might be more a piece that kind of maybe starts a larger project, because I think the work that they want to do on comparing planning legislation between provinces is much bigger than they'll be able to do with the kind of modest budget that they have right now. But I think all of these are kind of starting points that we can kind of build upon.
Yeah, and in terms of data collection, there's a lot that people can adopt, because I think, you know, doing traffic counts is something that you can do anywhere. So if you can come up with a way to do that in a consistent way that everybody does it the same way, that would be really helpful to make data more comparable between provinces, and like for longer term goals, and like similar things that are done for like air quality monitoring. If you could like have these monitoring programs for traffic counts going on, that would be helpful, I think.
Hi, this is Karen. I was just going to say, I think, you know, if you're doing things like traffic counts, I know that, for example, in New York, our transportation department does do screen line counts for cyclists as well at designated sites several times of the year. So, you know, I think on one of your slides, Erna, you had that some municipalities do, in fact, include the act of travel counts as part of the transport counts.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that you know, that's probably an important part of the work here. So, you know, if we're talking about transportation counts, I think active transportation counts should be a vital part, clearly, of what we're thinking about. I do have one question. The Canadian Community Health Survey, you said physical inactivity data is relatively lacking, but StatsCan CCHS does have data. What level is that data available at? Municipal, regional, provincial, like?
Provincial for sure. Regional, I think so. And it's, I think the smallest that you can get is like maybe Vancouver metropolitan area, and I'm not sure what that includes.
Yeah, because that's actually a really important piece because, you know, we're talking about the work that's being done in many class members in local jurisdictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing, you know, sort of what level that data boils down to is actually a really important piece, right? Because, for example, if you're a region, if you can actually drill down to the metropolitan area, you probably want that because, you know, your different municipalities are probably wanting to know how they compare to each other and to other places, as
mm-hmm.
well as the provincial data. But, you know, at the very least, knowing that you at least have regional level data is probably important. So that gives you a tool for both surveillance and evaluation over time, but
mm-hmm.
also as a way to make the case within your own community.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, like I said, there's Vancouver Coastal Health and Fraser Health are developing their My Health, My Community survey, and that is meant to collect those local-level data. But it's, so that's going to be a really important source of future information. And as far as I know, there aren't any other initiatives like that in the country. But if anybody here is aware of something similar happening, then that would be really interesting to know.
Yeah, you know, once Vancouver Coastal has developed their surveys, it may be interesting to share with, you know, when it's available and ready to share with the rest of the folks here so that, you know, should they want to develop similar surveys or surveillance systems for their own regions or cities, you know, they could use comparable questions potentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Claire, you're on the phone. Are you the person responsible for that project at Vancouver?
Thankfully, I'm not responsible, but I am involved with it. It's more of a survey platform than specifically just on active transportation. So it's an online survey platform that's intended to eventually give us longitudinal information rather than just a snapshot in time. So it will be an online survey that's supplemented by field surveyors going out to the populations that otherwise we wouldn't reach with an online format. And it will have we're launching it in June, and it will be the first the first launch will be a module that will take probably 20 minutes for people to fill in. So there's quite a bit, and it includes some active transportation questions. And then sort of as we go into the future, if this turns out to be a viable platform for ongoing, we can do specialized modules for different populations. So it's a bigger initiative than just the active transportation, but the goal is to get up to 2% response so that we can get down to the neighborhood level. What we heard from local governments is, you know, it's nice to know sort of the big level comparisons, you know, City of Vancouver or all of our rural areas, but they weren't able to use that information to justify investments or to see what was the result of a given intervention. And so that's what they're hoping will come from this survey. So we're partnering with municipalities on the survey. So it's a very big initiative that I think will be well worth watching over the next year or two.
So maybe, Claire, you could let us know if there's kind of pivotal points in the process where, you know, other people would really kind of benefit from hearing or, you know, seeing it online or something. Maybe you could let us know as it develops.
Certainly. I do have like a two-pager on the survey that I can send to you, Kim, if you want to
circulate. That would be terrific.
Circulate.
That would be great. Thank you very much. Okay. Any other last questions for Erna? So, Erna?
Yep.
Thank you very much for participating today. And unless there's any other questions, I'm going to keep us moving because we still have a few other things to discuss today. And any last questions for Erna before I let her go? Okay. So I'm going to just thank you very much, Erna, for participating today. It's been really helpful. And we'll hear from you when your report comes out.
Yeah, and that'll be in the next couple of weeks, I think. So.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Folks, I do have to leave now, so thanks all, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Take care. So, folks, I'm just going to turn the recorder off. So if you could just hang on for a second, there'll be a little bit of a pause, okay?